Okay, let's get started. Firstly, you've got to apologise. The second practical is still not quite ready, but it's almost there. As I emailed you on Friday, there is this second lab up now, which gives you introduction to some simple hardware designs described in this System C. Hardware description and simulation language. So if you haven't already, I encourage you right now to start looking at the simple models of hardware components and the simulations. And also in particular, have a look at this GTK Wave tool for viewing waveforms, because you'll find that very useful when you're actually doing the actual practical, which will be released soon. And if you find it very useful when you're debugging your code, because it's quite difficult to get your code right the first time. For this particular practical, you don't want to be starting to do things like inserting print statements into your code. With System C, there are technical reasons why this doesn't work well, but this GTK Wave tool will really help you kind of see what's happening over time to the different signals, and you should be using that as your primary means of debugging the designs that you come up with. All right, so the topic for today is I/O controllers and devices. So we're kind of moving around the different components of a computer that we've been looking at, the CPU architecture, we've been looking at memory, and now we're coming to input and output. So on a typical system, there are a variety of different I/O interfaces. Up here, we've just got a few kind of common examples. I say common, probably the lower ones are, these lower four are quite common these days. This one called RS-232 is probably mostly historical. You certainly don't see it on modern PCs at all. But anyway, so it's kind of, these are just examples of interfaces. And you're probably all familiar with at least some of these. You're familiar with USB interfaces, the various standards for video interfaces to monitors, for disks. The kind of most popular interface family right now goes by the name of Serial ATA. There's another name, SAS or SA SCSI. That's another kind of slightly older standard. Well, SCSI is an older standard. SAS is still around today in higher performance systems. And then quite commonly, computers have Ethernet ports to connect you to some local area network. So these are all kind of examples of I/O interfaces. What we're going to do in this lecture is going to look at a tiny bit of detail of what some of these interfaces look like, and talk a bit about the properties of the devices themselves. Really, we're probably just going to focus on disks here, but we'll be looking at the properties of these interfaces, a bit about disks, and we're looking at issues to do with transferring data back and forth between the CPU and memory, and these devices out here, about some of the decisions that you have to make, and reasons why you make those decisions one way rather than another. All right, so here's a typical organization these days of how I/O is connected to a CPU. So what we have at so we've got CPU at the top there. You now kind of have some picture, hopefully, of the fact that you've got a cache memory close to the CPU, maybe several levels of cache. But then you have, below these caches, you have what's called the main memory bus, which is a high-speed bus for interfacing to here the main memory. Typically, input-output devices don't connect directly to this bus here. This is like a kind of super highway. It's a four-lane motorway each way. And this is a little country road. This is for kind of slow-speed traffic that you don't want up here because it's just going to slow everything down and get in the way. So you have an adapter connecting the buses, and then typically your I/O devices, unless they're exceedingly high performance, will hang off this slow-speed I/O bus. Now we're going to look a bit about why. In a few slides' time, we'll kind of look a bit more at this architecture. So I'm going to spend a couple of slides now talking about this kind of simplest example of an interface. Okay, this is frozen on me again. A simple example is something called this RS-232 serial interface. So it's, you don't find it much on modern systems, but I'm going to talk about it here because many of the principles used in this interface are also found in modern serial interfaces as well. So what you hear here would also be relevant to modern serial interfaces. Typically, the name of the device that kind of manages such an interface is a UART or an ACIA. UART is usually the commonest name. UART standing for up there, it's the Universal Asynchronous Receiver and Transmitter. And we'll see shortly what this word asynchronous means in this context. So kind of 20, 30 years ago, if you wanted to network your computer and your computer was at home, or you just had a terminal at home, you might have an RS-232 interface to some kind of modem that would then talk over a telephone line. Inside the computer talking to the interface, there'd be a specific chip which implemented a UART. Electrically, very simple. You just got essentially three wires here, a ground wire, and then two wires for transmission of data, one in each direction. So kind of very simple there. And the question is, well, how do we get data down just a single wire, when what we're going to transmit are at least, say, bytes of data? And so we have conventions on how we serialize data, how we, say, take bytes and send them one at a time. And with this interface, this being an asynchronous interface, so what asynchronous means is that there isn't a clock. So we talked a few lectures ago about synchronous logic. And what makes synchronous logic special is that there's a clock, and the positive edges of that clock give a kind of heartbeat that governs how the whole processor actions actually happen. Sometimes interfaces have explicit clocks in them as well, and those clock signals control, that they kind of tell receiving devices when transmitted data should be sampled, or give an idea about when data coming back in should be sampled as well, or should be presented. With a serial interface, what happens is that the sending and receiving party have to agree beforehand, often by some other means, about what rate the data is going to come. And then there has to be facilities for the two parties having very slightly different ideas about that rate. I mean, they might have, each party might have some kind of frequency reference inside it, but those frequency references maybe may differ from each other in frequency by, I don't know, a few parts in a million. So over time, they would drift. So you couldn't trust that the positive edges of a clock inside one device, inside the sending device, would correspond to the positive edges of the of a clock in the receiving device. So what happens? So we decide how to serialize data. So we decide that, say, we're going to send, if we're going to send a byte of data, that we're going to send the least significant bit first. And so that's what we're seeing over here. We're seeing in the blue in the middle, we're seeing 7 or 8 bits trotted out serially. But what we do at the start is we say that when we're not sending any data, we say that, say, there's a logic 1 or a voltage corresponding to a logic 1 on a wire. And then before we actually send the data, we always say that we have a period where we just hold the wire at a logic 0. And we call this period, this kind of bit at the start, the start bit. And the idea is that the party on the other side is kind of waiting for this transition from a high to low level, and uses that to really synchronize then the subsequent sampling. So they'll the receiving end will know the period of each bit, and so it will know to start as soon as it sees this transition here. It'll know that firstly there's a start bit, but then kind of halfway through the next period will be a good time to sample bit 0 of the data. So here we're sending, sending 7 or 8 bits of data. Commonly we send a parity bit on the end. I don't know if I've talked about parity before, if you've seen the concept. Has anybody not seen the concept before? So everybody here knows what parity is. Yeah? Yeah. Okay, good. You all know then that, yeah, so a parity bit can even be, actually it's even described down here, just in case. So it's kind of counting up, it's telling you whether you've got an odd or even number of ones in your data. So you send this parity bit, and this just helps and gives you an ability to detect if there have been errors in transmission, that if the received parity bit is different from the actual parity of the preceding 7 or 8 bits, was not what you'd expect, you know that there's been a single bit corrupted, and maybe you have some protocol to say to the sender of the data, hey, look, I got an error on that last byte, please send that again. Perhaps we sometimes send what's called a stop bit at the end, being in logic 1, and then what this then does is it kind of gives you the chance then to resynchronize when you send the start bit for the next byte. So if you guarantee that at the end you always had a logic 1, you can kind of come back to a state like here and then drop down and send your next start bit immediately. But again, because you guarantee that there's a 1 to 0 transition between the stop bit and the start bit here, You provide this resynchronization opportunity. So after transmitting every byte of data, you've got this opportunity. So there's no chance for the clocks to get out of skew at all. In fact, this allows for the sending and receiving frequencies to even be a few percent different from each other, and still over a single byte, you won't run the danger of the sampling signal slipping too much from the center of each of the bit times. All right, so this is just kind of a simple example of a serial interface. Typically then, so we've got this UART device which converts data from a parallel byte interface to a serial interface, and vice versa. So you've got two halves to the UART. So you've got a receiver at the top, a transmitter at the bottom. So the receiver at the top takes in serial data. Typically we use a shift register data structure. If you remember back to the lecture on hardware design, we saw what a shift register was. So the data is shifted into the shift register when all the data's in, and we've seen the parity bit and perhaps have checked the parity, then the each of the outputs of the shift register can then be taken in parallel, and that's your data. So say we're taking 8 bits, and then we'll store that into some register of the receiver, and then the CPU, the processor, will be able to read the data from this register here. And one of the ideas of having a register is that then we store the data in the register, and then we can start loading in the next data over here while this data is still waiting here to be picked up. So we can be doing those two tasks at once. We don't have to. We can, if the process is reading fast enough, we can have a continual stream of data here, and everything's going to function okay. All right, so we've also got a couple of control signals here. The receiver status is a signal back to the CPU, perhaps telling the CPU, hey, a byte of data has been received. Do you want to do something with it? Read control, this could be just a read signal saying to the UART, hey, send this data right now, put it out onto a data bus which this is connected to. Also sometimes too, you can do things like you can, not shown here, but you might have other registers inside the receiver which actually allow the CPU to set what the clock rate should be for receiving data. So you can, it's not just it's fixed in hardware once and for all that it's going to receive at a given rate. It's programmable by the CPU writing certain data to certain control registers inside the UART. Down here on the transmitter side, we're kind of doing the opposite. The CPU writes data to this register here. Again, you could do things like you could write the kind of control signals coming in could allow you also to do things like writing the speed of transmission. And perhaps here there's a signal coming back saying, hey, I've finished sending the data. The idea of sending the data just gets transferred from this register here down to the shift register, loaded into it in parallel, and then we clock it out serially, and the serial data out comes here. So that's because the kind of high-level impressionistic look at what happens in a very simple input-output device. Let's look next at some of the options for how you connect the CPU to an I/O controller. So going way back to the first slide, there's this idea that we have a kind of piece of hardware called an I/O controller, which sits between the CPU and each of the actual kind of wire interfaces to these, or maybe even not wire interfaces, but the controller sits between the CPU and then kind of lower-level interfaces to the other devices themselves. All right, so some of these options are, I think these days, they look very much like straw men, that they're not kind of options that we realistically would follow, but historically, designers of CPUs or designers of computer systems went through these options, so we're kind of going to talk through them again right now, just because it kind of helps us realize why we are, why we do what we do today, typically. So first thing we could do is we could do option one up there. So that's, we connect the I/O so TX and RX are very common abbreviations for transmitter and receiver. So we could connect the I/O transmitter and receiver registers directly to some special CPU I/O registers. So within the CPU, we've kind of seen that we've got registers like this bank of general purpose registers. We can have a program counter. We can have special registers for recording interrupts coming into a CPU. So perhaps we could have some I/O registers as well. And while this, I'm sure this was done back in the 1940s, maybe it's kind of quickly been dismissed as just being way too rigid, that when we design the central part of a computer, we really don't know what kind of I/O devices we're going to connect, or there's going to be a variety of them, and this is just way too rigid. It's not flexible. The next thing we could do is to have, just like we've got a kind of buses hanging off our CPU which connect to the main memory, maybe we could have a special I/O bus hanging off the CPU which connects to these different I/O devices. If we did this, we could do this. We could, for example, have an I/O bus which has just perhaps got 8 bytes or transmits 8 bytes of data in parallel at a time, has some read and write signals allowing it to control the direction of transfer of data, maybe has a few address lines so that the CPU can say, hey, I want to send data to this I/O controller, but not this one. And then we could augment our instruction set with special load and store instructions, saying instead of load data from memory or write data to memory, we could say load data from some I/O controller or write data to an I/O controller. So it's more plausible. Typically, it kind of says up here expensive, not flexible. So expensive because you're adding extra dedicated hardware to the CPU. Expensive too because you're complicating your instruction set for your processor as well. And not as flexible as you might want. I mean, it may be that you it's not flexible because you might, I don't know, make some very constrained choice of number of address lines here, and then maybe you want to add another 10 I/O controllers and you just don't have enough address lines to talk to them all. But it's kind of inflexible compared with the next option coming up. So what is that? Well, the option is to make use of your memory space and have it that some of those memory addresses out there are not addresses of real memory which you just read and write, but are addresses of registers inside the I/O controllers. So we've got this address space for memory, which now also has small chunks which are used for talking to I/O devices instead. So here we're connecting then to the I/O devices through the memory bus, and this goes by the name of memory mapped I/O. So it's a very nice idea because from the CPU designer's point of view, he or she doesn't have to do anything extra. They've already got the logic there for loading and storing data from memory, but now we just decide particular addresses are addresses at which I/O controllers are going to sit instead of actual memory. The chief drawback of doing this is that we've got a bit of a bottleneck, perhaps. We're taking bus bandwidth away from the CPU and memory. I mean, we already saw with pipeline processors that you've got data coming back and forth and you've got instructions being pulled from memory, and there can be these pipeline stalls because you're a request of data from memory might conflict with the fetch of a new instruction or prevent the fetch of a new instruction. And interfacing to an I/O device, which typically is quite a slow device, might really cause problems and be like, according to the metaphor I was using at the beginning, it would be like kind of allowing horse and carts onto high-speed motorways. So instead we have kind of option four. So here the idea is we connect I/O controls to the I/O bus. So we have an I/O bus as before, but then we connect the I/O bus to the memory bus through a bus adapter. So way back here, this is then that picture for the fourth option. So here's the bus adapter, here's our memory bus, and here's our I/O bus. And the I/O bus is then the bus directly talking to the I/O controllers. All right, so the nice thing about this compared to option three is that now, so it says there, it says offloading memory bus, multiple I/O devices appear as a single device to the memory bus. Let me elaborate on what offload memory bus really means here. The kind of issue is that the rate at which data transfers can happen. But on the memory bus, it's a high performance bus. You're transmitting lots of data in very short times. With I/O data transfers, those data exchanges tend to be much slower. And what this this bus adapter does that connects between the memory bus and the I/O bus does is it acts as a speed buffer in the sense that say there's going to be a burst of data that the CPU wants to write to an I/O device. It can write it very quickly to the I/O adapter, and then the I/O adapter can then kind of talk much more slowly actually down to the I/O controllers themselves along the I/O bus. And also this I/O adapter can take in from the CPU 32-bit wide data transfers, and then spin those out as say 4 8-bit data transfers on our I/O bus. So this bus adapter is doing this kind of speed conversion job. It's presenting a high performance view to the CPU, where the CPU can read and write it at full speed and can read and write 32-bit quantities, but then it manages to talk also to the I/O devices across the I/O bus at a more slower sedate rate, which those units are expecting. So by doing that, then the I/O devices, the I/O controllers themselves, won't slow down nearly as much the data transfers that are then happening most of the time on the memory bus. So that's the kind of key to why option four is the kind of one that's frequently taken, almost universally taken these days. So here we have a picture of this story, another kind of version of that first slide. What's kind of interesting with this picture here is we actually see data is even wider than the 32 bits that you see normally. It's 128 bits here. And you might be a bit puzzled. You might think, well, I don't know, so far you've been spitting out stories of 32-bit processors and maybe 64-bit processors, but why are we talking about 128 bits of data here? Has anybody got any ideas why our main memory bus might be 128 bits wide? More main memory. You could make an argument around that, but that's not the key argument. So it's not there, but if we go back way to this first page, sorry, this one here. So there's a clue in that slide as to why the main memory bus might make sense for the main memory bus to be 128 bits wide, even say if our CPU is a 32-bit CPU. Okay, well, what's between the main memory bus and the CPU? A cache, right? And so the cache on the CPU side, the CPU can be talking 32-bit words to the cache. But remember, when you've got a cache and you've got a cache miss, what you want to do You want to get data as quickly as possible from the main memory into the cache. So remember too, the cache works with cache. It loads and stores cache blocks at a time. It doesn't just transfers of data between the cache and main memory aren't just transfers of individual words. They're transfers of whole blocks at once. So you're starting to see now why 128 bits maybe makes sense. You're getting data, say, compared to a 32-bit wide memory bus. You're getting data from the main memory four times more quickly. And you say writing it back to the main memory too from the cache four times more quickly. So yeah, the point is that transfers here are happening a block at a time. So it makes sense to have a fat memory bus to kind of give to increase the performance, even when the CPU is just reading 32-bit words at a time there. All right, let's move on. So here, there's nothing much more this diagram's providing you with. It's kind of showing, here's a UART, here's some registers which appear as at particular addresses on the I/O bus. So you still, to the CPU, each of these 8-bit, is that 8 bits? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, yeah. Each of these 8-bit registers appears at a certain address. We have registers for transmit data, receive data, and perhaps we've got a status register too, which we can read and write. And so if we read it, it tells us, yes, the receiver's got some data ready to be read, or maybe the transmitter's shift register's empty, please send me some more data. All right, going to look now at the issue of how you manage the timing of how you manage it when a program's running, how you manage the timing of I/O transfers. So say we've got the simple scenario where an I/O controller is receiving some data or has finished transmitting some data and it wants to be serviced. If it's sending data, it wants some more data from the CPU. If it's receiving data, it wants the CPU to pick up the current data so that some more data can be received. One thing that you could do is called a polling approach. So the idea of polling is that every so often a user process polls or questions or queries the I/O device saying, hey, do you need servicing? Do you need me to collect some data or do you need me to provide some more data? You can do this. It's not typically done very often for several reasons listed above. So you're kind of wasting a lot of CPU cycles because usually these I/O data transfers are happening at a much slower rate than the kind of processor can do work. It's time consuming, it's not that flexible because you're not allowing the CPU to go off and do other things. However, even though it's not particularly good, you do find it used in quite simple embedded systems sometimes. It will be used, say, if there isn't some other work that the CPU has got to go off and do. Or it might be used if you look at the overall fraction of time that's spent on I/O, if it's quite small, then it might still be okay for the CPU to spend some time in a polling loop, just polling the I/O device, waiting for something to happen. The kind of much more common, generally, option that's taken there is this option two, an interrupt-driven approach. So the idea here is, we talked about interrupts before, the idea here is that the CPU can set up an I/O transfer, and then the process which is doing the I/O can go to sleep, some other process can come in and work, and then the I/O controller can interrupt the CPU when it is ready for the next segment of data transfer. And so I/O, there's this interrupt-driven I/O usually makes a lot more sense. We'll return to interrupt-driven because there's in a few slides because there's some twists on how we do it. I want to talk just so going to have an example of a Another example of an I/O device, actually an example of I/O device rather than just a kind of I/O protocol. And so we're going to take a tiny look at a very simplified view of what hard disks look like. So if you look in the Patterson and Hennessy, they've got some nice photographs of disks opened up, so you can see what they look like. Here we've just got some kind of cartoon-like diagrams that give you some idea. So when you've got a hard disk drive, you really do have these spinning disks coated with magnetic materials, and you might have many of them arranged on a central axis. So here we're seeing the disks side on. If we look kind of down on one of the disks, they're spinning around some central axis, and then we have some head, and right at the top of the head, a bit like with an old-fashioned record player, we have a special magnetic device that can sense the magnetic data actually on the surface of the disk as the disk is spinning underneath the head, and then the head pivots backwards and forwards to select data off different tracks. So we have this vocabulary. We talk about a platter being one of these disks. Typically, you can record data on both sides of a platter, and so you've got a head on each side of it. That's actually not shown here, but that happens in general. You've got these tracks, and each track is then divided up into a sector. And these are just some ballpark numbers that give you some idea of the parameters we're talking about. So you might have up to 50,000 tracks, say 500 sectors per track, and then this kind of size of data, around a kilobyte roughly per sector. And these devices are spinning at anything up to 10,000, 15,000 revolutions per minute. So that's just some rough orientation. So when we're looking at disk performance, the kind of time to access data is really is usually divided into two parts. So we talk about this access time. That's time to get the head into position to read and write data. So it's usually made up of two parts, what's called a track seek time, or seek time, and a rotational latency. So seek time is the time for the head to move to kind of pivot backwards and forwards, move to the right track. And then rotational latency is the time then to, you're going to wait for the disk to go round until the right sector is underneath the head to actually read the data. And so this is very much dependent on how fast the disk is spinning. And so here you've got some kind of typical numbers. So typically both of these for a hard disk might be of the order of a few milliseconds these days. So when you want to read data, you've got this several millisecond latency right at the start between issuing a read command, say, and actually getting the data. And then you've got the transfer timer too, which is governed by things like the speed at which the disk's spinning and how densely tracks are recorded. These are, I think, already getting to be a bit outdated, but these are were a few years ago typical data rates you could get from disks. This is megabytes. Yeah, it's probably not too far off what you get today. So you can certainly see from these, I mean, even if this speed is decent, if you've got this several millisecond lag, you're going to be wasting a lot of time if you're just waiting for a disk to kind of get ready for you. Typically, inside a disk drive, you have this interface component called a disk controller, which kind of does two things. It also interfaces to the electromechanical components of the disk drive, so it controls the motor spinning the disk, it controls that head going backwards and forwards. But it also has the interface, and then it has the kind of interface to the electronics of the head itself for reading and writing data, and it has an interface for talking to the CPU. These disk drive controllers themselves are whole embedded computer systems these days. They're not just kind of custom hardware. Inside them, you've got these I/O registers used for exchanging data control. And typical of one of them, one of these registers is going to be a command register where you write to the controller kind of special bytecodes which tell the controller what the what you want to do next. So kind of thick commands that you might give to a disk controller are go to track N, read data, read sector M from that track, or write sector M from that track. So for this lecture, we're going to actually see an example where we talk through these here. But I should say, too, that if you could look at a modern disk and the modern disk controller and the protocols used, they're often at a higher level than this, that the controller itself is doing a lot of fancy management of the disk. Say it's got a memory buffer and a memory cache. And it may not even allow you to, from the operating system point of view, request certain sectors or request certain tracks. Or if you do, those won't actually correspond to the physical tracks and sectors. They'll just be a pretense presented to the CPU because it makes programming the part of the operating system that interfaces to the disk easier. But internally, they might be doing something quite different. But so that's kind of what's really going on. But this story here kind of was a true story and kind of is a true story if you actually look within the disk controller itself. So then it's worth following, worth pursuing. So here's a kind of typical sequence of steps that the operating system and the disk controller might go through if you were interfacing to a disk controller and if you're kind of requesting some data. So what have we got here? Step one, use a program, request data from a file. If the OS operating system knows about how data is laid out on disk, it says, well, okay, I know that data should be on this sector. So that's step two. Then the operating system might say to the disk controller, hey, look, move your head over to this sector where I think the data is. And so there might be a seek command sent out to the disk controller. At this stage, let's assume we're working in a multitasking environment. The CPU is not going to wait that few milliseconds, waste those millions of instruction opportunities. It's going to go off and put the process to sleep that's request the data, and some other processes are going to step in there. When the data is ready, the I/O controller will interrupt the CPU to say, "Hey, I've got my head in place now. What should I do next?" In this case, the operating system says to the controller, "Okay, right, you're on the right track, but now I want you to go to this sector and read data from this particular sector." Again, the disk has to take time to spin round so the CPU can go off and do something else. And when the I/O controller is ready, it interrupts the CPU. So that's taken us now down to step six here. This stage now, the data is ready to be streamed. And so if we're reading data, the data is going to be streamed from the I/O controller to the CPU. And if it's the other way around, the data is going to flow the other way. And maybe there's going to be, you're going to want to read data from many sectors. Maybe you kind of go back in a loop to step five, or maybe even go back to step three. This is quite a fine-grained story of data transfer. If you're wanting to transfer many megabytes of data, there's a lot of to and froing going on here between the CPU and the disk controller, in a modern system, this would be more streamlined. But this gives you the basic idea. So if we do this, so I've kind of told a story so far using interrupts. This is kind of better than the polling approach, but it's still not it's kind of far from ideal. So we still these data transfers can be relatively slow compared to the speed that the CPU is operating on, and we've got these commands issued to read every sector, which seems a bit wasteful, and there may be some. So it says time taken by interrupt mechanism makes it difficult to synchronize head position with read sector command. It might be that we want to kind of read adjacent sectors, but we kind of the CPU misses an opportunity to read the next sector soon enough, and then the disk kind of spins around again. There's a synchronization. There can be synchronization issues here, and there's a solution then called DMA, or direct memory access, which is a third approach to that you can take instead of polling, instead of just driving things by interrupts for every single sector transfer. So what is direct memory access? What you do is you add an extra piece of hardware whose job it is to manage data transfers to and from memory and I/O devices. And this addresses some of the previous problems. So this bypasses the need of a program running on the CPU to actually just be pulling in data byte by byte from the I/O controller and then storing it byte by byte into memory. That's such a simple operation. It's quite easy to design a piece of hardware to do the same thing. So this DMA controller might have kind of two or three registers. Again, this would be a memory mapped device. You might write to it an address in memory to start a data transfer. It might have a data register for temporarily storing data to be transferred. And it might have a length register, which tells the DMA register how many blocks to actually transfer. I think there's a picture of one here. And the idea is that the CPU, that if you want to, say, transmit a whole burst of data between a disk and memory, the CPU will initialize the contents of these registers, the address register, say, and the length register for transfer, and will somehow tell the DMA controller, too, about which particular I/O controller you want to talk to for the disk, and then the CPU will just let the DMA controller rip, will let it kind of go away, and it will then take over this address bus. So far we've talked about address buses just being driven by the CPU, but in practice in systems, a DMA controller can also output addresses onto an address bus and address memory. And then the DMA controller can also read data from memory, just like the CPU does. And so the DMA controller takes over the job of transferring the data from the disk via the data bus over here into memory, or sucking it out of memory and then streaming it onto the disk itself. So these DMA controllers are found in almost all hardware systems that have disks, have kind of I/O devices where you're wanting to send large bursts of data. So here's another kind of step-by-step account of what's going on. Here, in this particular story, still we've got these seek commands to find a track, the read sector command to find the sector, and again we're kind of doing things here by interrupts. But now what's happening is the DMA controller is really taking over, and perhaps the I/O controller too is taking over the job of reading multiple sectors. So once the operating system is set up read from the first sector, it doesn't have to tell the disk controller where the other sectors are going to come from. And only when the data transfer is complete does the DMA controller have to come back and tell the CPU, hey, look, I've completed, And now the CPU process, the process that wants the data, just has to look in memory to find that data. So as I was saying, there's this issue of what's called bus arbitration, this issue of now more than one device wants to be the what's called a bus master, so be in charge of the address bus and in charge of the data bus transfers. And what we introduce when we're looking at hardware organization is a device called a bus arbiter, which allows different bus masters, like the DMA controller, like the CPU, to make requests for the bus resource, to say, look, I want to access the memory. And then there's some negotiation that goes on, and this arbiter, this component which makes decisions, will take in bus requests, these are the requests for use of the bus, and then it will issue bus grants saying, look, okay, now you can use the bus, and now you can use the bus. And of course, only one, the arbiter makes sure that only one person is granted access to the bus, to the main memory buses at one time. All right. That's kind of it for what I wanted to go through today. But you might just enjoy reading through this as well. So this is just a kind of a perspective on just how far we've gone with modern technology for disk drives. I mean, it really is quite incredible what's going on when you look at the speed at which the disks are spinning and the tiny dimensions of the read heads and the spacing between these read heads and the platters themselves. All right, so that's it for I/O controllers and I/O. So just kind of finished our tour around a computer system looking at the aspects of the hardware. So from now on, what happens? So we kind of completed from a lecture perspective, the main content of the course from an examination point of view. So we've gone through at some level all the examinable material. What have we got left? So we've got the second practical. Now, especially with the second practical, it really is a learning experience as well as a kind of just doing an assessment experience, even though we're assessing it. So when you're doing it, it really will help you kind of understand better the whole concept of CPU organization and how data transfers are happening within the CPU. So really, do get when I issue it, there will be 2 weeks to do it in. The idea now is that probably, so it'll be out something by tomorrow, and you'll have until Wednesday in 2 weeks' time to do it. So there'll be plenty of time to do it. But please get into the labs early, talk to the lab demonstrators if you've got any issues about understanding what's being asked of you. So we've got that coming up. And in terms of lectures, I'll probably do at least one lecture kind of going over some aspects of things related to the lab. Maybe even do two lectures, I haven't quite decided yet. So that will be happening today's Tuesday will be happening on Friday this week, and then Tuesday of next week. So we'll still got one or two more lectures to come that will be certainly relevant to the lab and certainly giving you some background to what you're doing when you're doing the lab. All right, thank you.